My name is Kyone Wolf. I'm a survivalist. I teach survival skills. In fact, I personally met Gloria Gaynor, who sang I Will Survive. She looked at me, and she said, that's what I'm talking about.
My name is Greg. I was a theater major at Carnegie Mellon, and I've been a street mime.
I'm going to be left naked in a jungle in Costa Panama, Uruguay. Actually, I don't really know which country it is, and there are poisonous snakes and frogs that if you just touch them, you pass out. I'm looking forward to beating one of those frogs with a stick and stuffing it into the mouth of one of those snakes while I stomp it to death while being naked.
I'm a little unclear about this particular thing I'm doing. My agent said it would be very similar to a production I did in Santa Fe of Brecht's Three Penny Opera, in which there was full frontal nudity. I hear the show is in a jungle, but apparently we won't always be walking because I've been told the jungle is full of jaguars.
You know, I'm comfortable with my body, so I'm not freaked out by being naked. I see my partner as one of my survival tools, so I'm kind of hoping that he'll be a total bag in case I have to sacrifice him for my own good.
We've been here naked for 6 days. All I've had to eat was half a mango I had to wrestle away from a monkey. I've been bitten 3 times by poisonous snakes and once by an alligator. Each time, I had the impression that Kyone pushed me into its path. One thing is becoming clear. This is no Brecht production being staged in a jungle.
Hey, Green Puff, come here.
No, all you ever do is get things to bite me so they won't bite you.
Hey, I'm not here to make friends. Now stand right here, pansy boy.
Okay. Ow! That jaguar bit me!
Yeah, and while it did, I pole-axed it, and now it has a concussion. So come on, fist bump me with the hand that's not mangled, okay, panty waist?
It already looks infected!
Here, rub some of this spider poop on it. Do you know nothing about survival? See, this is why I'm gonna win the prize, man.
There is no prize. That's what the assistant producer said right before the monitor lizard ate him. The only prize is pride of accomplishment or something.
Okay, that stinks. And you stink, too. This whole place stinks. I could be home, comfortable, and warm watching some other naked idiots do this. Do you see this pack of monkeys? That's my prize. I win the monkey prize, and now I'm going home. Meanwhile, this show is about the world of modern reality shows. And now, the star of The Bachelor Assisted Living Edition, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, it's kind of The Bachelor going for kind of a different demographic. All right, yeah, we're going to talk about reality television today. We have a fascinating group of guests for you. With me in studio is Shane Lewis. He was a participant on Naked and Afraid, upon which that introduction was based, loosely. On the Discovery Channel, he's the author of an autobiography, Growing Up. Growing Up Institutionalized to Globetrotting. More information about Shane at shaneoffthegrid.com. A little bit later on the show, we'll be rejoined by Eric Deggans. He's been with us before. He's the new TV critic for NPR, the author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. To get us started here, Rebecca Hertz is joining us from the studios of KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. She is a television producer and writer based in Los Angeles. Her work has been featured on Glenn Washington's Snap Judgment, but she's also worked on 28 different reality shows. She writes scripts, manages on-air talent, maps out story arcs, edits footage. She does it all. Rebecca Hertz, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
How does a person become the person that you are? How do you wind up working on 28 different shows?
Well, I was very fortunate to have begun my career right at the beginning of the boom in reality television. So I came out of graduate school and started at the bottom and worked my way up rather quickly.
The beginning of the boom, I'm assuming, kind of around the turn of the century, late 90s, early 2000s. That's when we really started to see.
Yeah, 2001 is when I began.
So, yeah, you did. You caught the wave. And so do you feel really fortunate to have done this? I mean, is this a good life or is it a hard life?
It's both. The career I've had is has taken me all around the world. It's fairly lucrative. It's not as lucrative as scripted television. Mm-hmm. And it's often very fun. It's very, very hard work. It's harder in terms of hours and, there's a lot of uphill battles. Mm-hmm. When you're making shows, especially new shows, compared to scripted, So it's very challenging. It can be very rewarding.
What's the show that you've worked on that you're the proudest of, that was the sort of the best experience for you, the show that you felt the best about afterwards?
Probably King of the Nerds, which I did last year.
Now, King of the Nerds is sort of in that kind of unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, depends on your perspective, a lot of public radio listeners may be somewhat unfamiliar with the vast genre and subgenres of reality TV. King of the Nerds does kind of fall into what we call a competition elimination, right?
That's correct. I've spent most of my career in competition elimination with some side ventures in what we'd call docuseries or dating shows.
And we'll explain all this to you as we go along. Don't get intimidated, but competition elimination is King of the Nerds, Survivor, dating shows, The Apprentice. Those are all shows where somebody wins, a whole bunch of people lose. And I think since you just used the word scripted television, too, I think this is sort of a good time to sort of have one of the first conversations we're going to have. A lot of people have questions about reality television and sort of how it's arrived at. And people who have paid any attention to this at all are beginning to understand that it's certainly not just sort of raw, unedited footage, raw, uncoached footage. So I'm going to just bring into this Shane Lewis. Shane Lewis, you were on what's a fairly new show. It's called Naked and Afraid. It's sort of in the elimination and competition subgenre, except that, as was suggested in the intro, you're not really exactly competing for a prize, right? You're just explain what the show is.
Yeah, there was no prize. The show is just they wanted to drop two people who did not know each other at all and did not know anything about each other into the middle of nowhere in different locations remote around the world and without clothes and said, okay, get your own food, get your own water, you know, build your own lodging, and we're going to see how you do it.
Kill your own snakes.
Kill your own snakes, whatever, you know.
All right. So and some of the hook obviously was that you're naked.
Yeah, that's correct. Yep.
Yeah. Was that ultimately important that you were naked? Or I mean, after a few days, I noticed you guys had like banana leaves in certain places and stuff.
Yeah, some of the teammates that I've – some of the cast members you know, covered up pretty quickly and were very uncomfortable about it. I didn't put anything on for 6 days because I had a lot of work to do. Mm. My teammate wasn't helping me at all. So I told the camera crew that I will put clothes on when I'm done with the goals that I had to get accomplished for, you know, self-preservation.
So, Rebecca Hertz, I think you did not work on Naked and Afraid, but right away as you're listening to this, you probably have some questions and some surmises, too. For example, just overall, as you're listening to Shane talk, what are you thinking, just as a producer, as somebody who would have to do this? What would be the challenges that you'd see coming?
Well, my main experience of listening to Shane, not just now, but right before we went to air, is that he's an excellent person to cast because he has a lot of opinions. He doesn't have any – it doesn't sound like he has any self-doubt, and he will not be afraid to express them. So what I look for, what we all look for in cast members on these shows is somebody who's going to give us a pure soundbite.
That's what the producers, they told me that's what they loved about me the most, was that I was the purest of the cast members.
Right. If you have a lot of boundaries, if you're the kind of person who has sort of walls up, who thinks carefully before they speak, Rebecca, you're probably not going to be that good on reality television.
It's not that you won't be good. It's that
you'll be the person with boundaries.
You're more difficult to edit.
Yeah.
To be quite honest.
I have no filter.
You have no filter, yeah.
Period.
Well, so Rebecca, I want to sort of pin this down a little bit because I do think one of the questions people have is, all right, so we talk about reality TV and its opposite being scripted TV. But I think people are increasingly beginning to understand that reality TV isn't purely unscripted, right?
That's correct.
Give us kind of a sense of that. When you're trying to get something out of a particular sequence on reality TV, when you're trying to make a scene work, what kinds of things would you do to make a scene work?
Well, what people don't understand about making reality TV is that it is a craft. Hmm. And it takes highly skilled people to make good television. So what I do starts from pre-production and it goes all the way through editing. In order to tell a good story, first you need to pre-produce it. So I would look for people like Shane, who I can be sure will react with very little, as he said, filter or boundaries to the beautiful and perfect container that I have designed for him, which I would call the format of the show. So it's already been written. As soon as I create the format of the show, which is, for instance, in his case, I'm going to put two people naked into a jungle and they have to survive. That's the format. That's the container. Now I have to find the perfect cast members to place in that so that I'm going to get a dramatic situation. I'm going to get conflict and I'm going to get great sound bites. And then that's just what I'm getting in the field. Mm. The real work, the real writing happens in the edit. And I understand, Shane, you probably aren't that pleased with how you were portrayed or how it was edited, because your experience of doing the show is vastly different than what you watched. Now, that is not, you are not alone. Mm. Probably every single person who's ever done a reality show has the same experience, because my job as a producer is to tell stories. I'm not beholden to the truth. I don't really care about the truth. Mm. What care about is
ratings.
a dramatic arc. Mm. I don't care about ratings. I just want to be quite clear. The network cares about ratings. I care about storytelling.
And so let's get to Shane's experience a little bit here. So one of the first things you do, obviously, is sign some kind of fairly lengthy document, which you probably didn't read all that carefully.
Oh, I did read it carefully.
Yeah.
I have a couple of college degrees. I'm well educated. It was interesting to read. There's a lot of funny things in it that I was laughing about, and just contractual stuff. It was fun. But I didn't care about the contract. I didn't do it for TV, and I didn't do it for any kind of notoriety. I did it for the sheer fun of it, because I enjoy pushing my body to the max. I mean, I've picked up a backpack and I drop myself into continents with nothing for months and months and months. For 13 years, I averaged 5 months a year out of the country, backpacking around the world. And I spent three total years of the last 7 years of my life in third world countries. So I didn't have a problem with it.
So you did sign the contract. You did release a certain amount of control. You did allow them to start doing editing. And is Rebecca right? Were you unhappy with how things came out?
I have some issues with the editing. Not so much the things that I said. I fear nothing that I say. I mean, I've growing up in boarding schools and institutions all my life without parents, I fear nothing. Especially my mouth. I know it's unfiltered, and I don't have a problem with the ramifications of it. My problem with it was the things that they left out, not necessarily what they put in. I don't care that they made me look like a woman-hating tyrant, but I was a little more frustrated that they didn't put in certain things. Other than that, I had a really good time, though.
What were the certain things?
My teammates' inability to handle the situation.
Mm-hmm. So your teammate was in more trouble and needed more help, too? I mean, basically, watching Naked and Afraid, we mainly see you guys alone and trying to cope. Was somebody rushing in with a bowl of broth once in a while?
No, they didn't. They did not interfere with us at all. They didn't tell us what to do. They didn't do anything. They just dropped us in there and said, you can do whatever you want to do. They tried to coax me to do things, but I pretty much told them, I'm going to do what I want. And in my contract, it says you're observer, so I don't really care what you want. I'm out here trying to survive. You can get as mad as you want at me for it, but I don't care what you have to say.
So, I mean, the most circulated clip probably from this series with you in it is there's a snake called a fer de lance, which is an incredibly dangerous snake.
Yeah, my executive producer was bit the day before the show started filming. And apparently at this point that happened in the end of March, March 23rd, and he is still not walking correctly.
Yeah. But, I mean, not walking correctly is that's the good outcome. The bad outcome is you die. I mean, these things are really dangerous. So we did see you kill this fer de lance. And so I guess it wasn't like taped to the ground or anything. I mean, you didn't have any assistance. You just went over there with two sticks and killed this.
I had one stick in my hand, and yeah. I had to manufacture the stick that I killed him with as I saw him, because yeah. I was just kind of looking for grubs. I mean, I was starving. My teammate was starving. We hadn't eaten anything in literally 6 days. And so I was just looking for food, and I thought I was going to find some king grubs, and it didn't happen. I found the snake instead. And so I had to manufacture a stick to kill it. Yeah.
All right.
I had the upper hand because he was sleeping, though.
Yeah. Well, that's not a distinction I would bother with if I were in your shoes, except that I would have been running really fast in the other direction. So, Rebecca Hertz, I would imagine that there's a gradient of manipulation that goes on. I mean, here, Naked and Afraid, I don't know, they're naked and afraid. There's maybe not that much that they're going to do. But, you know, when I watch reality TV, I have the sense that if I'm watching Honey Boo Boo and they're standing at a counter in a, you know, barbecue place or something, that there's a producer crouching down behind the counter and maybe telling the counter person what to say, or in some way really trying to orchestrate what's happening. You know, am I just a paranoid, cynical creep? Well,
no,
I might be, actually.
Well, I can't speak to that, but I can certainly agree with you that anything you're watching on television has a script attached to it, whether it happened prior to shooting or after shooting. Somebody wrote it.
Or maybe in the middle of shooting. So in other words, you know, I mean, it's good. I think as we talk, the more we talk to Shane, the more we're going to see. I think the script maybe came after that they began to sort of assemble the story in a way that they
Well, there's different kinds of reality television. So the kind that Shane participated in and the kind that is, you know, the elimination competition genre, you go and you shoot it first, you design a perfect container, you get the good cast, and then you shoot it, and then you edit it and script it later. And then what you're talking about is what we call a follow doc, or docu-series, or docu-soap, or docudrama, comedy doc, whatever. These include Honey Boo Boo, The Housewives, Duck Dynasty, all of those shows, and they are scripted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah.
And there's a script.
There's a script. And there are people that you don't see who are, you know, somewhere around a lot of the time trying to make things go a certain way in a way that
there's a director, there's cameramen, there's camera angles, they do different takes, they get a master, they get a wide, they get their singles, they get reaction shots, they get pickups, there's a script.
They did some of that with us, and I was very frustrated by it because they were taking up my time, and it was difficult to have to retake things and re-say things the way that they, you know, in better lighting or better angles, and, you know, especially as the 3 weeks went along, because I was so depleted from energy and I would have to stand up and do it again. And I'm like, talking to you guys is the most exhausting thing that I do out here.
Go ahead, Rebecca. Yeah.
Oh, no, it's television.
Yeah.
It's not reality.
I got it.
So the primary purpose, you know, whatever the producer is doing out there is because they need to make the show. They need to put the show together.
I think it's societally comical that they even classify it as reality TV. I mean, there's nothing real about it at all.
Well, except that it was real, that you were there naked in the jungle with snakes and stuff like that. I mean, that's real,
well,
right?
Well, my show, I'm not a reality TV connoisseur, but I feel that my show, the one I participated in, was a little bit different because they had very little script and because they couldn't tell us what to do. It's not like they could plant animals around and plant food around. I mean, we had to go by what we had, so...
You know, a common thread, though, I mean, as Rebecca, as you were kind of alluding to, these shows can be really, really different. I mean, Duck Dynasty is just a whole different animal from The Apprentice or from Survivor or something like that. I mean, and The Real Housewives is different from, and there are, you know, they have different needs. Although the common need might be that person without that much of a filter or that person whose boundaries are pretty relaxed. I know one producer in this field who makes these docu shows, and he's worked with this one woman who will call him up and say, well, you know, today I have to go see the gynecologist, and he'll be sort of bracing for, you know, so go away. And she'll say, so call the crew. I mean, you want the one thing you do need is somebody who is willing to put on display things that many other people would prefer to keep private, right?
I suppose so. I guess I look at it differently. We work with people who are not actors. Mm. So we must create a situation in which they can react with emotion without pretending.
Well, let me pause you there. So you want them to react with emotion without pretending. But is it not the case that at times you really do have to sort of work to get the emotion that's desirable? I mean, we're not just talking about the kind of retakes. But I mean, do you have to do things to make people cry sometimes?
Yes, of course. But that's what I'm saying. They're not actors. So I actually have to make them cry if I want them to cry.
How do you?
So I have to.
How do you
I have to put them in a. I have to put a girl who wouldn't go to, to the bathroom in a porta potty in the jungle without clothes on. She'll cry. Mm. She's going to cry. So that's one way. Another way is to sit them in a chair in a dark room with a light in their face and a camera in their face and manipulate them psychologically until they cry. And I'm not, you know, I mean, that's a skill.
Yeah. And I suppose part of the equation is here, the unspoken thing is they knew what they were getting into. Do they really know what they're getting into? I mean, do people who
no.
No, they don't.
They think they do.
Yeah.
They think they're going to game the system. But what they don't they couldn't possibly understand is that the system that's been built to make one of these shows is far smarter than they could be ever.
So if your favorite roommate from college was thinking about going on one of these shows, what would you say to that person?
Oh, this has happened many times. People have called me and said, I'm being asked to do this, blah, 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 blah. And I say, if you're willing to be absolutely powerless over how you're portrayed, go for it.
Mm-hmm. And Eric, Shane, excuse me, is that something you would agree with? I mean, if you knew somebody you liked who was thinking about doing one of these shows, not necessarily Naked and Afraid, but one of these shows, would you say something similar to what Rebecca just said, or would you say don't do it, or what would you say?
No, I would say pretty much the same thing Rebecca said, that just get ready for, you know, they are going to spin you in the worst possible ways for sheer entertainment in ways that you can't even begin to imagine. So if you're ready to handle that and embrace that, then go for it and have fun.
In just a second, we're going to add a third voice here, Eric Deggans, our go-to guy about television. He's the new television critic for NPR. We'll take a little break. We'll come back after this.
I bet that we'll go far because my family is the star. The reality show is coming to our house. We dyed our cat bright purple and the dog has leather boots. Grandma's jumping off the house with a homemade parachute. Uncle Bob is busy printing $100 bills. The camera crew is here. Won't they be so thrilled? The reality show is coming to our house. The cameras are in the living room. I bet that we'll go far, 'cause my family is the star. The reality show is coming to our house. Oh, the reality show is coming to our house. Maybe we'll be famous on TV. If we act like freaks, they'll put us on this week. The reality show is coming to our house. The reality show is coming to our house.
You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. With us is Shane Lewis, a participant on Naked and Afraid on the Discovery Channel. His book is Growing Up Institutionalized to Globetrotting. And also with us, Rebecca Hertz from the studios of KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. She has worked on many, many different reality shows. Joining us in just one second is Eric Deggans, the new TV critic for NPR. Before I bring Eric in, though, Shane, in some ways maybe we've kind of poisonous leapfrogged over... I mean, just sort of, you were out in the jungle for 3 weeks. What's the thumbnail description of what happened? I mean, the show's already aired. It aired last summer. What do people see when they see the show? What do they see happening? Because you're not in it to win it, right? There isn't anything you can win. So what was the show ultimately the story of?
The story I felt was, and it's actually what intrigued me to participate in it, was just the sheer challenge. How do you adapt to an environment? Because they didn't tell us the location. I mean, I didn't get my flight schedule until like 6 days before I left, and then it was a general location. I had no idea where they were dropping me. I didn't know if it was going to be an island. I didn't know what country. I didn't know anything until like 5 days beforehand. So that part of it was very, very intriguing to me. Actually, they didn't even have our location and, you know, my particular location until like days before they gave me my flight schedule. So that part. And the other thing is, it's just the sheer will of, you know, how strong are you? How can you adapt? How do you survive in a situation where you've got nothing and the difficulty of it just, you know.
So we saw you in the jungle for 3 weeks and you just sort of, you made it. That was the story basically, right?
Yeah. How do you make it? You know, how do you go about it? What is the process? What is your skill level? What is your adaptability? How did you personally go about, you know, tackling the obstacles that were presenting themselves daily?
But it's also the story of a relationship. And look, the imagery isn't subtle. It's Adam and Eve, basically.
Correct.
You know, you're naked in what could be paradise, but there's some nasty things in paradise.
Yes, there are.
And it's the story then of, you know, are you Adam and Eve in any real sense? And in which sense? So it's the story really of a relationship between a man and a woman. And your relationship is the one that didn't go that well.
Yeah, me and Kim, we had our differences. We did not get along on very few levels. And that's well documented. She did her thing and I did my thing. And we had issues.
Yeah. She ate the apple, you killed the serpent.
Something like that.
All right, here's Eric Deggans. He joins us right now. Rebecca Hertz also still with us. So Eric Deggans, the last time you and I were together, I said that I was really sorry that you had to watch so much reality TV, but you don't seem that sorry about it. You like it, or you're interested in it. So first of all, just maybe for people, NPR listeners who are not that keyed in, What's the phenomenon about? I mean, some people say it's about economics. It's about, in fact, the capacity of television to make pretty compelling shows, but without the kinds of budgets and costs of a scripted series. Is that the main thing there is to it, or is it more than that?
Well, I think now the reality TV genre has evolved to the point where cost isn't as much of a factor for the big reality shows that everybody knows about. Shows like, I guess ostensibly The Voice might be considered a competition reality show. A show like Survivor, the big cost that you don't have with a show like Survivor or some shows that feature civilians is that the contestants don't get paid that much. But all the other costs are the same as a regular series or even more. The amount of money that they spend to send a production crew to cover The Amazing Race is comparable to what they would spend to send Anthony Bourdain around the world, except they're doing it for like 12 people. So, you know, they're saving money in that they're not paying the talent that much, but otherwise a lot of the production costs are the same because they're really trying to make these shows look good and they're traveling all over the place. But initially they started as a way to do cheaper programming that the network had more control over because the stars would be non-celebrities who didn't get paid that much and didn't have any leverage. Now I think what's happened is that young people especially, I have this theory that they've grown up, young people nowadays, 18, 19, 20, have grown up watching Nickelodeon and these youth-oriented channels where a lot of the comedies are scripted multi-camera sitcoms. Like Miley Cyrus's show Hannah Montana, some of the other ones that we've seen, Selena Gomez's show. So by the time they get to be 18 or 19 years old and they're right at the beginning of that key demographic for advertisers on television, they're sick of multi-camera sitcoms. They're sick of the – it feels like something that young people watch, that babies watch, you know, little kids watch, and they're looking for a kind of entertainment programming on television that feels fresh and new. And along comes reality, so-called reality TV shows like Honey Boo Boo and Duck Dynasty and Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives. And all of a sudden, you have the same elements. They're pretty much like sitcoms, except they're done in the reality TV style. And I think that's what people are responding to. So reality started as one thing, and now it's become something else.
Rebecca Hertz, I heard you begging to differ a little bit earlier in what Eric was saying.
The producers do not get compensated in the same way that writers get compensated on scripted television. So I would have to say that, yes, the cast does not get paid, nor do they have the power that they have in scripted. But also the producers, who are actually the writers and the creators and the makers of the content. So I don't get residuals. I'm not in a union. I don't have pension. I don't have health care. And neither do any of my colleagues.
So that's an interesting
right.
part of it all.
But to not confuse the issue, but also those shows don't repeat that well. So when you're talking about a show like Mad Men or Breaking Bad, that's a show that airs once on AMC, and then it goes on Netflix, and then it goes on all these other platforms, and they make all kinds of different money off of them. But a lot of reality shows, some repeat really well, some are on Netflix, but a lot of those shows don't. And so, you know, does the network make the same kind of money off of, you know, Naked and Afraid that they make off of Big Bang Theory or Bad Men or Breaking Bad? I'm not sure. So, I don't have access to those ledgers. But, you know, they are cheaper, but a lot of the lesser reality shows especially don't make the same kind of money either.
How about that for the performers? I mean, Shane Lewis, I know you just got off what I said, like a pretty grueling 12-hour shift where you work. So I'm assuming Naked and Afraid did not make you independently wealthy or lead to other show business opportunities that have made it possible for you to live a life of ease and comfort.
No, and I didn't go into it expecting that either. It is what it is. I did it for the fun of it, just the sheer fun of it, you know.
Did you get paid anything?
We got paid a little bit. I got what I wanted out of it, so I bought a skydiving rig with the money that I got paid for, so I'm happy. And I got paid to travel to Costa Rica and hang out in the jungle for 3 weeks. I mean, it was an absolutely beautiful location. I mean, incredibly difficult, and the challenges were impossible, but it was beautiful. Mm.
So, Rebecca Hertz, you agree with Eric Deggans' theory that one of the big audiences then was this sort of Nickelodeon-saturated audience that got tired of the multi-camera sitcom and wanted to see something that felt more vivid?
I think that's a compelling theory.
I mean, who else is the... I mean, I'll give you my theory. When I started watching these shows, and I haven't watched a lot of them, but my theory about the competition elimination show is I always feel as though television is showing you something that you can't have, and you get to sort of wallow in something that's very appealing to you because you can't get it. And one of the things that I think is true in real life is it's really hard to get rid of people. You know, if there's people at work that you don't like, that doesn't make any difference. They're going to come into work every day. And if there's people in your family that you don't like, well, they're your family. You're never getting rid of them. So, and you look around, and in general, people don't go away. It's almost impossible to get rid of anybody. But on competition elimination shows, people go away. People that you don't like go away.
Colin, I got to say, I think you're telling us more about yourself than you really are.
It could be. It could
be. What I always tell people when I talk about television is that 90%, 95% of why something happens on television is that somebody's making money or somebody's losing money. So you have to think to yourself, who makes money on reality TV and why? Reality TV shows make money because young people watch them. Young people watch them more reliably and in greater numbers than they watch a lot of scripted television, especially comedies. It used to be that sitcoms were the money pot for television. A show like Seinfeld would make tremendous amounts of money because it would draw a huge audience when it aired on network television, and then when they sold it into syndication, it would make even more money. But nowadays, very, very few comedies make that transition. The Big Bang Theory is the last one to do it. Most TV comedies don't make that kind of money. 30 Rock doesn't make that kind of money. Parks and Rec doesn't make that kind of money, even though they're very good comedies. But reality TV shows, because they're cheaper, they can draw a younger audience that doesn't necessarily show up in big numbers for TV comedies. So why are younger people watching these shows? Because when they watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians, there's a whiff of celebrity, and there's a whiff of sort of you're seeing something real between people. For some reason, it feels like it might be something that sort of kind of happened with these people that they're used to seeing on, you know, e-entertainment television.
I think we have to look at the values behind these shows. Yeah. I think we have to look at thematically or the subtext of the values of these shows. And for the most part, they are competition, greed, jealousy,
yeah,
envy.
I agree with that. We live in a very uber narcissistic world where we like to attack each other these days. It doesn't seem we are more quicker to take each other apart than we are to give each other compliments. And I think the reality TV shows are feeding that. They're feeding the angst, the drama, the constant attacking each other, the high school mentality where we're at each other's throats and we love it. I mean, we cut each other off in our cars, we're cussing everybody out, we're frustrated all the time. And I think, you know, the narcissism of it and the anger that everybody has and the pent up frustration, especially amongst the youth, they just, you know, they're feeling left out, they're feeling lost, they're feeling like society's, you know, just frustrated with them, and they're frustrated back, so they're getting out their angst. They're watching us perform and us attack each other and us be eliminated or ridiculed, and then they blog about it for hours and hours and hours about how much, you know, we're jerks and, you know, did you see what that person did last night? It's just drama, drama, drama.
Well, yeah.
I would agree with what you're saying, but I would just say that at that time in your life when you are 18, 19, 20, think about what was most important in your life, your relationships with your friends and who liked you and who didn't like you and who was dating who and who did you fight with. And, Big Brother recreates all the dynamics
exactly.
of your first years in a college dorm.
Exactly.
And, Survivor recreates that time, those times when you didn't get picked for the dodgeball squad or when you tried out for football or whatever. Each one of these, The Bachelor takes the hothouse of sort of being with mean girls and who gets the guy and turns it into a network TV show. It's all about distilling those moments for young people's lives and turning them into TV entertainment. And older people may vibe with some of that, but those shows are really about recreating. When you get older, you get over all of that.
Yeah, the thrill of the train wreck.
Exactly. How to process all that. But when you're young, you're in the thick of it.
Exactly.
And that's why these shows attract young people.
Yeah, go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, I would say if you look at the demographics watching Dance Moms, for instance, on Lifetime, it's women from, I think it's like 35-year-old women or something are the biggest demographic watching that show. So I would say that I wish that by the time you're a 35-year-old woman, you've gotten over that. But that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, I appear on the Bachelor Special Assisted Living Edition. So every show has its own demographic.
I would watch.
My teenage daughters love Dance Moms, so I don't know what that means.
Rebecca Hertz, one of the things that that Eric was alluding to and that Shane has alluded to, I think, these shows all they have to have kind of tripwires built into them. The tripwires that people kind of recognize that evoke certain kinds of emotional reactions. One of the things that they often need is a villain. Because as you said at the beginning, Rebecca, you're trying to tell a story. Most stories have a hero. Most of them have a villain. Mm-hmm. Shane is raising his arms in triumph, having been
they
a reality.
Need a villain.
Having been a reality. Well, I wanted to ask Rebecca about that. Do you decide when you're casting and when you're pulling in people to be on the show that somebody's going to be a villain? Do you decide during the shooting? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, when you present your cast to the network, you have to tell them who's going to play what role.
So Omarosa.
You already know.
Yeah, Omarosa. I want to hear Eric Deggans about Omarosa, but just to sort of pick a villain maybe that people know. Omarosa on one of the early Apprentice shows kind of got identified as a villain. Your guess would be then that the people making that show knew going in that she was going to be archetypal in some way?
Absolutely. I mean, they knew they hit the jackpot when they got her in their first casting interview because the network approved her for a reason. The network watches. If you're casting 12 people on a show, they probably watch 30 casting tapes. And that means the casting people have watched hundreds and they distill them down. So, the network, you go to the network and you say, here's 12 options for the villain, or here's 5 options for the villain, or here's 5 options for the ditzy blonde, or here's 5 options for the, dumb jock. Here's 5 options for the black person. Here's 5 options for the, whatever it is, the whatever the role is that they're trying to fill. The network knows. The producers know. That's what they're designing. They're designing a show in which there's going to be a villain. There's going to be a hero. It doesn't necessarily always happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we can be surprised, which I love personally as a producer, to be surprised by characters. And I love to tell stories that, are more than just an inch deep. But going in.
Right. We're going to take a break. I want to pursue this a little bit more with Eric and with Shane, who I think did get defined a certain way. And so let's talk some more about this when we come back.
They got shows about being left in Timbuktu, shows about eating some cow dung stew, about losing the weight off your derriere, and about marrying a guy who's a millionaire, who really isn't a millionaire. About dating someone that you don't know, finding a needle in a haystack in Mexico. Well, here's a show I'd really like to see, a whole show just about being me. It'd be empty bottles and knocking on wood, your mom telling.
Ever since my partner Greg was killed by the python on the naked zip line, he hasn't been pulling his own weight, and it's really starting to piss me off. I have to do everything while he just sits there decomposing. Stupid dead partner. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our naked and afraid interns, Garrett Connolly and Jonathan Scranton. Voiceover help in the intro by Greg Hill. The part of Bill Curry was played by Omarosa. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, we have so much that I want to cover in so little time. This show is flying by here. But I want to come back to this idea of the villain. Shane Lewis, you were, I think, by your own agreement, you ultimately came out of your episode of Naked and Afraid as the villain, as the bad guy. I mean, there were only two choices and only two people on your episode. But and do you think that Rebecca's right, that they knew right away when they were looking at you before they even pushed you out into the jungle that you were going to be a villain, that they were going to be able to make you a villain?
Oh, I knew that going in because the casting producer – they flew me out to L.A. and did some casting sessions, and I met the casting producer, and we talked about that in my room, off camera, off the record, and we had a great time discussing it and how vibrant and unfiltered my personality is. They were amazed by me in seconds, and when they brought me in the room, they were like, we need to, where's your personality? Where's your personality? As I came in, I was like, well, put a mic on me, and then I'll give you my personality. I got producers in the other room that I wasn't allowed to meet who were saying, they can't hear me, and I was telling jokes and being sarcastic to everyone, and they were like, put a mic on them. And I knew it immediately.
So, and then obviously the thing is edited to sort of pull out your most villainous qualities and make them front and center. Does that have consequences for you? I mean, do you have people who come up to you in airports and coffee shops and say, you bastard?
I haven't had anyone publicly say it. Everyone who has come up to me, and I've traveled around the world since the show has aired. I mean, I've had people in Puerto Rico. I've had surfers come out and paddle out on their surfboards and be like, hey, you're the guy on the show. And I've had the funniest experience I had was on a flight. And then this guy asked me if I was the guy on the show. And I said, yeah. He said, you look like you put your weight back on. And then the other passengers around me ordered the internet and watched my TV show right in front of me on the plane. That was a little weird. But I do wake up every morning and I've got 10 or 15 people that are just teeing off on how much of a difficult human being I am.
Thank you for that.
On my blog. And it's like, wow, you guys are awful colorful and creative about discussing about how I should go play in traffic. It's like hit by a bus. And the reason why my parents kicked me out of the house when I was 6 years old is because they couldn't handle the shame of having such a pleasant child as me, as their son. And I was like, wow, this is my blog, people,
Well, Eric, one of the things, just to go back to Omarosa for a second, because there's ways in which people can be decided upon as villains. And so Shane, maybe out in L.A., gave the producers a little help understanding, how he could be portrayed. But I think one of the things that you would argue in one chapter of your book, Race Baiter, is about how reality TV handles some of these issues. So maybe they look at somebody like Omarosa, and she fits a specific kind of archetype, or she kicks a specific kind of tripwire that maybe has something to do with her personality, but also just kind of an idea that's already out there about a certain kind of person.
Yeah, using stereotypes to cast people on reality shows. So part of what any casting director does is say, who does this actor or who does this character, who does this person evoke in the audience? What kind of reaction does the audience have to that person? And I think when you're casting people on reality shows, there's a mighty temptation to use stereotypes to help define that person. So particularly on reality shows like Big Brother and The Apprentice, there's been these people who've been on the show have said that people of color who get slotted on these shows either fit one of two poles. They're either the over-emotional, angry black person, or they're the milquetoast black person who kind of fades into the background, who is sort of negligible and never at the center of the action. I heard that a lot from people who'd been on The Apprentice, for example. So Omarosa got cast because she's obviously somebody who has a strong belief in herself, and she has a lot of racial stuff that she's dealing with. I think she had a hard time dealing with the other white people that she had to deal with on the competition, and she seemed kind of quick to accuse other people of racism, even though she was doing some pretty awful stuff herself. And for whatever reason, the producers decided she would make a perfect villain. But the problem is, then America sees that show, and there's just one or two black people on that show, and one of them is somebody who is, flinging these spurious charges about racism and is quick to anger and fills all the stereotypes of the quote-unquote angry black woman. And it's not necessarily to say that Omarosa isn't that person, although she claims that stuff was exaggerated, and other women who've been portrayed that way on these shows claim that they've been exaggerated. The problem is that it furthers these stereotypes about people of color that are already out there in the media, and where there are already too few media representations to counter them. And then you also see on The Bachelor, for example, they've never had a non-white person be the bachelor or bachelorette. This upcoming season, they're going to have a Venezuelan man be the bachelor, but he doesn't really look like someone who's not white. He's a white Hispanic, even though he's from Venezuela. And so it's sort of like, who gets to be the person who gets to be Prince Charming? Who gets to be the person who gets to be the princess on these shows? And then when people of color don't get to access those roles, what does it say about society and how TV treats those characters?
You know, just as we're about to wrap up here, we're kind of running out of time. You know, Rebecca Hertz, you're obviously a really smart person, and you seem like a nice person, and you're refreshingly frank about all this. What's a nice person like you doing in an industry like this? It seems like a very tough industry. Is there any part of you that thinks, I'm going to cash my next check, I'm going to an ashram for a month, and I'm going to come out, and I'm going to do something else?
I've done that several times.
And they keep pulling you back.
I am now at a stage in my career where I can pick the shows that I work on. So I no longer have to work on shows that I know going in are going to be make me feel like an evil monster, which is really great. And I'm proud of myself that I've gotten here. But those shows are still there, and I still get asked to do them all the time. And I may have to do one or two in my career if going forward, if you know I can't find anything else. But I think what I found when I first started and as I've gone forward is that I have to do a lot of work on myself to organize how, because there's a cognitive dissonance between how I have to behave as a producer and who I am morally and what my values are. But honestly, and you know, I can't speak for everybody who has a job in America, but I think that there's alienation in the system of capitalism. I think there's people are alienated at work. They have to separate who they are inside from what they're doing out in the world. And I think that comes with the territory of working.
This is a longer and more fascinating conversation.
Well, if I could say something real quickly.
Actually, I just want to
commend you for being willing to be so honest about how the industry works on this show. I've never heard a reality TV producer speak as honestly as you have, and I really appreciate hearing that.
That's why we booked her. And so, Shane, we've got a very short amount of time left, but let's imagine the phone rings as you're walking out of here, and it's, "Hi, I'm Donald Trump. I saw you on Naked and Afraid. I'd like you to come on The Apprentice." I mean, you've just sort of linked some of these shows with the twilight of civilization. Would you do another one of them?
No. I when I first did the show, I told Discovery, I was like, if this is going to be some kind of social experiment, do not call me back. But if you're actually looking for some raw, you know, real reality show and how hard it is to try to survive in a foreign environment, I'll go for it.
So that's the only part of it that really intrigued you, was that part of it?
Exactly.
So you wouldn't do The Apprentice?
No, I would not do The Apprentice, no.
How about if I could get you a lot of money to do The Apprentice? Let's talk later. All right, listen, you guys have been fabulous. What a great panel. Eric Deggans, it's always great to have Eric Deggans here. He is the new TV critic for NPR. Shane Lewis, participant in Naked and Afraid on the Discovery Channel, author of Growing Up Institutionalized Globetrotting. Rebecca Hertz, the most honest producer in all of reality television.
Yeah, I appreciate your candor, Rebecca. That's awesome.
I hope you enjoyed that. Our most recent three shows have been rebroadcast while I've been traveling. I'll be back tomorrow, and we'll pick things up with an edition of The Scramble, our live show based on recent headlines. Later this week, we'll do a show about the value of singing together in choirs and choral groups and glee clubs, and a live broadcast from downtown Hartford, where some of the nation's hottest young playwrights have written a series of short plays about what happened to Cindy Lou Who, Charlie Brown, Tiny Tim, all those characters after the Christmas cameras stopped rolling. So come back and join us for all of that.
With my fill of concessions and sorrow, but that's how it goes on the almost reality. Oh, the humanity, almost reality show.
I'm Kyone Wolf. I've been bit by something. I don't know what it is, but I think this might be the end of me.
Cut! That's a wrap.
Ugh, finally. Someone get me a towel for the hot tub.